ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Every single woman and ally who is here today will not stop raising our voices.
Calls for a national emergency to be declared after 26 violent deaths of women so far this year. Rallies are getting underway right now to kick off a weekend of protest. So what will stop women being violently killed? Would it help if there were more females in powerful roles? Well, we're off to one town in WA where women are dominating leadership roles. That's up in 4 minutes. And
when I opened my eyes, I saw those three dingoes behind me. And the first reaction was obviously to try to leave.
Tourists again coming in for some close attention from dingoes on Gurree. G'day, Jono Kendall here, talking with you from Gunai Kurnai country in Sale, Victoria, broadcasting on your radio, online and the ABC Listen app. The first of 12 anti-violence rallies planned for this weekend are underway in Ballarat and Newcastle right now as campaigners call for a national emergency to be declared over violence against women. So far, 26 women have been killed this year, including Molly Ticehurst in Forbes in New South Wales on Monday, Emma Bates in Cobram, Victoria on Tuesday, and Rebecca Young, Samantha Murphy and Hannah Maguire in Ballarat earlier this year. Sarah Williams is the founder of What Were You Wearing and has been organising these rallies. G'day, Sarah. Do you think we have more of a problem in regional Australia?
Definitely. It's more of an issue in regional areas. And the sad thing is, regional areas don't have access to the same services major cities do. I am a survivor of domestic violence from a regional city. And when I was going through this and needing help, there wasn't much around me. So many services were either already booked up or to get to an available service was actually quite far. It wasn't very accessible. Speaking to a lot of women in these regional towns the past week, a lot of these areas are the areas where they've lost a woman recently. You know, Ballarat lost three women since the start of 2024. Just this week, we've had Forbes and Cobram. We've got a rally just been organised in Cobram for this weekend as well. And, you know, I think it was just yesterday that we lost another life there. So it really goes to show there's an issue in regional towns, but it goes to show we need more funding, we need more commitments in regional towns, and we definitely need more support out there. I think that we need men in the conversation. We need them to do a lot of the talking. We need men to call out their friends when they do bad behaviours or they say something that's not okay. And we need women posting about this on Instagram, using social media to their benefit to really get education out there. But we also really do need the government to announce and acknowledge that this is a national emergency. I do strongly believe that if 30 people were killed to a shark attack, there would be some introduced law or something new come about. This isn't just a new issue. It's been happening for forever. Every year, there is one too many deaths to violence against women. The fact we're at 4 months into the year where already 30 women lost is absolutely appalling. And, yeah, I really do hope and expect that Anthony Albanese will make that statement this weekend.
What would you hope that happens after this rally? You spoke about some political action from Anthony Albanese, but in a perfect world, what would you like?
So I'd like to see domestic, family and sexual violence services actually funded properly, and the ones that get funding actually on a minimum contract of 5 years. The services who are paid that I've spoken to, they struggle because their contract commitments are 1 year, and then they spend that 1 year trying to find more funding for future years. The issues are not going to end within 1 year. You know, it's going to be a couple of decades until, so we need really good, strong commitments from government. But we also need to fund behaviour change programs and preventative measures. Our organisation, What We're Wearing, for example, we do a lot of workshops. We do a lot of different preventative type stuff, and we're not funded by the government at all. The only way we're able to run our services at the moment is by just generous community members that give us donations. And I know for a fact if we were properly funded, we would be able to reach all the regional areas and actually reach a lot more further people. And that's both survivors that need our help, but also potential perpetrators that need to have their behaviours changed.
Sarah Williams is the founder of What Were You Wearing, which has been organising rallies against violence against women over the weekend. And if you need help, call 1-800-RESPECT or 1-800-737-732.
ABC Australia-wide.
Rural Australia has more men than women, but in one outback town in Western Australia, women are dominating leadership roles. Mount Magnet, about 600 kilometres north of Perth in WA's Murchison region, is a hotspot for mining and farming. But it has also become a hub for women who work in senior roles like business management. Piper Duffy has the story.
Every single job that I've held so far, I've been able to contribute in some way and be passionate about.
It means the world to me, working on country with Mumob.
It's been absolutely lovely. Like, they've been so supportive. It's a great small town.
These women all live in Mount Magnet, a country town home to under 500 people and located 600 kilometres north of Perth in Western Australia's Murchison region. You might be wondering what else they have in common. Well, they all work in senior leadership jobs. Actually, almost every management role in the town is held by a woman.
There's no glass ceiling. Women are encouraged to just be and do what they are and to excel at what they do.
Trailie Cable became the Shire of Mount Magnet's first female CEO 2 years ago, but she didn't always see herself as someone who would one day work in leadership.
When I left school, I was not going to work. I was going to be a stay-at-home mum. That was my decision. And circumstances, as are for most people, especially women, circumstances, family, early days of FIFO that were not kind to families. I ended up in some roles that have just been an absolute pleasure for me, and I am so fortunate to be in the role that I'm in right now. Being fifth generation from regional Western Australia, I'm very passionate about the direction we're taking and stopping us from becoming a dying thing.
Stacey Burgess, who now owns and runs the Mount Magnet Post Office, also never saw herself working in business management until life took a different route.
That was never an option, I think, coming up from Perth and, you know, 2 kids and trying to do it all and had the help of a partner. But, yeah, it was a lot of work, a lot of people helping me out as well. I would never have gotten here if it wasn't for my partner especially, but the friends that I've made along the way and the connections that I've made in town and to know that people in town weren't opposed to having me as the new owner, because I know country towns are very, they're very tight-knit, and it was very nice to be sort of accepted straight away because they already knew me. I previously worked at the Shire and little places around town.
Meanwhile, Buttermeyer Woman and Bitty Bitty Centrecare Programs Coordinator Polly Dan says she's always been a very business-orientated woman.
I'm the nana, auntie, sister, you know, I'm all that, and I hold a level of respect here. I have that status in the community and people respect that. It means the world to me, working on country with my mob. Look at what I can do, always look for solutions, don't get too wrapped up in the concerns, just, okay, then how can we make this work? And the positivity, you know, especially with the community. I don't get nothing from this, but I love how my mob, and that's why I'm here, and I get told by people who visit, why are you in Magnet? And I'm just like, why wouldn't I be? Because I have 2 degrees, very educated. And I'm just like, well, I'd rather be here doing it with my mob than anywhere else.
Ms Cable says these women and many more demonstrate the regions are a place where people can thrive.
My position on this is, you know, it's not unusual because, you know, we all have something to contribute. What is unusual is that's not what the stereotype that we all expect of a small country town in regional Western Australia. I'd really love to encourage other women across Australia to consider going regional because the opportunities out here are great, they're huge and vast, and the reward is great and huge and vast as well, similarly. And I'd strongly encourage anyone to come out. Don't be frightened to come regional. The support is there and the small community is there. In fact, you probably get a much greater support, to be honest.
Piper Duffy with that story from WA's Murchison region. Australia has a reputation for having some of the most dangerous animals in the world, something many international visitors are quite conscious of when they arrive here. But one French tourist wasn't anticipating making headlines for a snappy encounter with a wild dingo while sunbathing on the Queensland island of Gurree. Today, she's urging visitors to respect the wild animals. Fraser Coast reporter Lucy Loram has this story.
I felt something on my bum, and I started to hear like the people around going like.
Visiting Australia on the trip of a lifetime, Tia Bourdieu thought it was safe to rest her eyes while sunbathing on the beach.
And when I opened my eyes, I saw those 3 dingoes behind me, and the first reaction was obviously to try to leave, and it's when I did that, then the dingo just nipped me. Oh my god. Oh. It was just a little nip. Like I have like three teeth marked.
The French tourist was visiting the largest sand island in the world, Gari, in 2023, when she had the close encounter with the dingo, known in traditional Batchelor language as the Wongari.
It was just one of those animals in Australia that you cannot touch and you cannot pet, and you have loads of them. So...
Fortunately, Tia walked away unscathed. But these dangerous run-ins are becoming more common on the island. Queensland Parks and Wildlife Service report there have been 12 of these high-risk incidents in the past 4 months. Head Ranger Linda Berendorf says it's more than double compared to the same time last year.
So that could be because of increased visitor numbers in families, or it could be an increase in some of the high-risk behaviour that we might be experienced with the dingoes at this time. They will be triggered by running, any sort of running or movement if they're in the vicinity. If they're hunting swamp wallabies or things like that, if that prey runs, they will chase it.
Dr. Berendorf says there's enough educational resources around to keep visitors safe. They just have to be willing to listen.
I think that you would have to be driving around with your eyes closed if you couldn't see the signage. It's behind nearly all the toilet doors in the public areas. It's on the buildings. It's at the activity areas. There's websites. But when you buy your permits, that we have so much dingo education out there, and it's currently being enhanced by the Be Dingo Safe Enhancement Program. So you're going to see billboards, stickers, kids' activity books, and all sorts of things that will be reiterating that dingo safe messages in order to keep you safe and keep dingo safe as well.
In data obtained from the Department of Environment, Science and Innovation, in 2023, 60% of visitors who were chased, stalked or attacked by dingoes were children. Batchelor Aboriginal Corporation Ranger Tessa Wire says the message is clear. Keep children close, walk with a stick and don't interact with the dingoes.
You know, if you go to Northern Territory or up to the Cape, there's crocodiles in there, and people see those signs and are very, you know, cautious about that. Same thing with our wongaris, you know, they're on the island. You might not see them, but they're watching you. Yeah, so I mean, it is important for your children to stay close. I mean, I know people are on holiday, you know, so they're in holiday mode, but keeping in mind that, you know, this place is the wongari's country. He's there somewhere, and it's quite important that people understand that there is a big difference from your domestic dog to these fellas that are the wild, you know, like your wolves, your lions, you know. You wouldn't jump out of a car if the lion was over there trying to get a picture with them, and, you know, because they're cute and cuddly, you know. It's a wild animal. He's not leaving his country going over to yours, you know what I mean? He's on his own country. So when he walks around there, that's his place. So it's just making sure that people understand and respecting that's the Wongari's footprint. That's his land. And, yeah, they need to manage themselves properly. Going over there.
The dingo bite wasn't Tia's first wild Australian animal encounter, but no nips or stings could lessen her appreciation of the native flora and fauna.
I used to stay in a host family in Brisbane, and when I just got to Australia, I got stung by a jellyfish in the sea. And I was like, I'm not going to be mad at all the jellyfish who are in the sea because I got stung by one. That doesn't make sense. Like, and it's the same with the dingoes. I mean, I'm on their island, so they're not supposed to change anything because I'm here. It's me. I'm supposed to change my behavior because they're there. So, yeah.
French tourist Tia Boudieu ending that report from Lucy Loram. Gin is an incredibly popular spirit in Australia, but did you know the main ingredient to make it, juniper berries, are mostly imported? Lucy Vincent is a farmer at Bibbenlouk in the Snowy Mountains, 2 hours south of Canberra. She's growing juniper and supplying it to a distiller in the Bega Valley to make gin. And she wants to see more farmers supporting the Australian gin industry. Adrienne Reardon has the story.
That is the sound of juniper berries being picked from their thorny branches and falling into a plastic tub below. It's a cool morning at Lucy Vincent's property in Bibbenlouk, at the foothills of the Snowy Mountains, where she and her family are harvesting the juniper by hand. It's hard work, but she's on a mission to change how gin is made in Australia. She wants to see more juniper berries grown on shore.
Most Australian artisan gins that are made, which are awesome, but most of them are made with juniper that comes from overseas, so Italy, Bulgaria, Greece, Macedonia, those places. There are three gins in Australia that are made with Australian juniper only. And so I want to change that. I want there to be more so that consumers can actually honestly see the provenance of what they're tasting.
Lucy, who was an agricultural scientist, took over the family farm a few years ago, but she knew she wanted to try something different. So, alongside having cattle, she and her partner, Bruce Campbell, decided to grow juniper, which is the essential ingredient of gin that gives the spirit its distinctive flavour.
We knew that we wouldn't be able to compete with others around us just from an experience point of view. So it was traditionally just grazing land, so cattle and sheep. We do still have cattle on the property, but we decided we wanted to do something else. If you think about the weather we have here, we have really cold winters, normally get snow once a year or so, really hot summers, and of course we're high up from an altitude point of view. It's not much that grows in all of those conditions, and surprisingly, each of those things is what you need for a really good juniper crop.
Juniper berries are actually the female seed cones of a type of conifer. Lucy and Bruce planted their first trees in 2018 and now have close to 600. Lucy has gone to great lengths to see just how good her juniper berries actually are by having them scientifically tested and compared to imported produce. The University of Tasmania compared the yields of four Australian juniper berries to those from overseas as part of a research thesis in 2023. Here's Professor Dugald Close.
So we had three different sites or locations of juniper berries from New South Wales. We had one from Victoria, and we compared them to a range of imported berries, but notably from Macedonia, where traditionally the best quality berries come from that are used in gin. The Australian samples, one sample was essentially, in terms of yield, exactly the same essential oil yield, but the other four samples were significantly higher. So in terms of essential oil yield, we're seeing really positive yields coming out either at the benchmark or above the benchmark of the international product.
The results were a relief for Lucy, who was already collaborating with a local distiller. Gavin Hughes co-runs the award-winning North of Eden gin based in nearby Bega with his partner Karen Tushi. He decided to join forces with Lucy after she paid a visit to his distillery.
Lucy just came out to the cellar door one day and introduced herself and said, "Hey, I'm growing juniper bushes." And so it was really a chance meeting. And then she said, "Well, you know, if we ever grow any fruit, would you be interested in purchasing it from us?" And I said, "Sure," because really the whole ethos of our business is to have gins which actually reflect the place of the part of the world that we're in. So we use things that we either grow on the farm or we forage for locally. And one big missing piece of the puzzle with gin, of course, is juniper, because 99.9% of it is imported into Australia.
Gavin and Karen have been using imported juniper berries for their gin since 2019. It costs around $40 a kilogram, but making the switch to locally grown juniper, although more costly at $50 a kilo, was an opportunity too good to pass up.
So to be able to take Australian-grown juniper, grown within 100 kilometres from here, near Bombala, is just a fantastic thing. It lowers our carbon footprint, but makes it a truly Australian gin.
Even researchers like Professor Dugald Close can see the potential.
I think distillers can express in their gin the local influence of our terroir, so that's the climate and soil effects on locally grown juniper trees. So this is something that's quite unique and could well be a selling point.
Lucy and Gavin admit it could be at least a decade before growing juniper berries really takes off in Australia. Lucy says her farm will need to invest in mechanical harvesting rather than picking the prickly juniper by hand to make the business commercially viable. In the meantime, Lucy is dedicated to helping support the country's emerging juniper berry industry by setting up the Aussie Juniper Growers Group. But she's hopeful about the future.
For me, obviously I want a farm that's commercially viable for my family, but really I want to have a really well-established juniper industry in Australia. So 20 years time, I'll be a happy person if there's a thriving juniper industry in Australia.
Bibbinlook-based juniper berry farmer and agricultural scientist Lucy Vincent there. For more on that story, head to our website, or you can catch Landline this Sunday on ABC TV from 12:30, or catch up on ABC iView. Many young children enjoy horse riding in regional Australia, maybe being a part of a pony club and show jumping competitions as well. Despite that interest, they often don't think about a career in horse racing. Even those like 13-year-old Stacey Edwards from the small Victorian town of Casterton, 50 minutes east of Mount Gambier, whose mother is a trainer and whose sister is a jockey. That has turned around, though, after Stacey won the small pony category in the first National Pony Racing Series final on her horse Napoleon in Sydney. Eugene Boisvert reports from Casterton.
Stacey won the final in a close finish at the Royal Randwick Racecourse after driving with her family and her horse from Casterton in the southwestern corner of Victoria.
It's a very big thrill just to even get to go that far. Oh, I was so nervous. I didn't know what to think. I nearly cried before I raced because I was just so nervous. And just to even get there was so good. I was happy just to even get there and let alone win. But yeah, it was a very close finish.
Yeah, how did you get Napoleon over the line?
Just push him to the end and we got there. We sat behind the first place getter nearly the whole way, and then we finally got there. Just pushed him to the end and we got there. I'm so happy.
What's he like as a horse?
He can be very much of a handful. He can sometimes leave you on the ground as quick as look if you're not careful.
The series was set up by a group called Thoroughbred Industry Careers as a way to spark an interest in children in horse racing. It's worked for Stacey.
Racing, I don't know, it's just fun, and there's so many different careers in racing, and it's not just jockeys and stuff, it's a lot of other things, and yeah, it's a lot different.
So before this, were you interested in becoming a jockey, or has this got you more interested?
I wasn't really interested in being a jockey, but then when I did my first pony race, I really wanted to be a jockey after that, and it's made my dreams come a bit more true and possible.
Competitors had to go to a taster day and then a training day at a metropolitan racecourse where they got to see a bit of the glamour and also the hard work around racing. Then last weekend they went to Randwick as well as the elite Godolphin Stables northwest of the city. Lindy Morris founded Thoroughbred Industry Careers and set up the new series. While the jockey aspect gets kids interested, she says it's actually about promoting all the other jobs involved in racing.
We did quite a bit of research before we launched this, and our research told us that the awareness was very, very low.
And you think it is a good industry or sport to get involved in?
For sure. You know, if you love horses and you have a passion for them and you want to do something that you're passionate about, there's something for everyone.
Because I imagine there wouldn't be many opportunities to race like this. You know, you're going from, you know, riding or being, you know, leading at pony club to this is quite like a big step up. Is that right?
The kids that are riding in these events are very accomplished. You know, they'd be some of the best show jumpers and sporting kids. You know, you name it, they're some of the best in the business at what they do at their age. So, in fact, if you think about a show jumping course or a cross-country course, you know, racing straight down a line on a beautiful surface is probably not as complicated as a lot of the other sports they do with horses. So, but, you know, it's an opportunity to compete on the big stage, you know, on the television. And quite often equestrian sports never really reach the mainstream media. You know, they don't get any attention. You could be in your local town, you could be the best 12-year-old horse rider in that town and no one would even know you exist. So it's been interesting, you know, everyone celebrating the skills of these kids, which is fascinating because they're so highly skilled.
One opportunity coming up soon for Stacey might be to lead the races out in next month's Casterton Cup. Casterton Racing Club Chair Mark Davis says Stacey deserves the honour.
It was a great achievement from Stacey. From a little girl from a little country town to travel all that way and come home with the victory, it was great to see, and she's made the town buzz with the excitement of it all.
Stacey can't wait.
That would be great. It would be such a miracle to do that. That would be really nice.
Has everyone here in Casterton and, you know, other horse racing people you know been really supportive or been happy to see how well you've gone?
Yeah, well, the whole town of Casterton pretty much have been so good, cheering me on to the end, and I couldn't have done it, to be honest, without Casterton. They helped me get there, doing little things or just helping us as much as they can. It was so, so good.
Because you can become apprentice jockey pretty young, can't you? Is that something you've looked at?
Yeah, I looked at that. Mum wants me to do year 12, but I reckon get out as soon as you can and do what you want.
Eugene Boisvert reporting from Casterton near the Victoria-South Australia border. And that's Australia Wide for this Friday and the week. Thanks for your company. I'll be back with you on Monday. Have a great weekend.
ABC Listen.